Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
I hope you're sitting down for this. George Barna's Cultural Research Center found only 13% of born-again Christians have a biblical worldview. That means there's a huge lack of biblical life essentials in our country. AFA is committed to helping churches ignite a hunger for God. You can be part of that with your gift today, and we'll send you Dr. Alex McFarland's DVD, Do Christians Have Permission to Edit Scripture? Visit afa.net/biblical. afa.net/biblical.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, November 6th, and the fallout from the sweeping Democrat win on Tuesday is actually causing some people to think about what is really going on in the country and not just rest on our laurels that Trump won a sweeping victory in November of 2024, but looking ahead to saying, okay, there is going to be a post-Trump world, and the Republican Party actually has to stand on something beyond Trump's personality. And Trumpism and Trumpiness and, you know, whatever you want to call it, is all well and good, and it works for Donald Trump, but it's not really going to work for anybody else. And the Republican Party and conservatives in general are going to have to recognize that we have to embed our worldview into the next generation. They're not going to pick it up just by osmosis. And the whole Islamification of the West, really, we need to seriously consider that impact. And the broader scope of this, of course, is the worldview impact. And my good friend Steve Dace posted a really good thread on X that you really need to read that discusses the worldview implications in the outflow of the election and some of his thoughts. So he joins me now to discuss. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Jenna. How are you doing?
You know, I'm in a contemplative mood today. I think that we should contemplate where we are in the state of the world. How about you?
I agree. I think people need to understand that to some degree, we are already operating in the post-Trump GOP, and that Trump can never be at the top of a ballot ever again to carry us. And so we're already one step into what's going to come next. And on one hand, Trump can never be at the top of the ballot ever again to define and carry us in an election and define what an election is about and who it's about. And then on the other hand, sadly, and still amazingly, I got to tell you, I still look at my text messages every few days wondering why I haven't gotten a text from Charlie yet. But amazingly and sadly, we also don't have right now and anymore the leader that was poised to step into part of that space on defining from a worldview standpoint where we are going to go. Because you know that human behavior, we have a lot of very smart people. Charlie was one of the smartest. I've met people smarter than Charlie. But you understand how humans work. There's a reason why when you get a group of pastors together, the first question they ask each other is, how many were at your church last week? You know, there's all kinds of really smart people that have modest platforms that could be amazing apostolic level leaders. But the reality is, because of the way human nature works, they're just never going to be noticed. And the combination of Charlie's ability to raise resources, and one thing I think that goes often unsaid about his legacy is, think of he ran the largest, most lucrative nonprofit in the entire MAGA movement, and not even a hint of any financial scandal at all when you know this as well as anybody, just to stand next to Donald Trump made you a target for prosecution for the last few years, let alone to work with him at the level Charlie did. Not even a hint of scandal. You don't think the Biden IRS went through Charlie's 990 form about 666 times? Because I'm guessing they did. Okay? Nothing. Nothing at all. And so the ability to raise resources, the ability to articulate message, the size of platform he had also was made him a bit of an enforcer, for lack of a better description, that kept some of the what I like to call reactionary retardation elements at bay. And now we don't have that guiding light at the same time. And so I think we are wholly unprepared for what politics is going to be moving forward, starting in next year's midterms, in fact, without a strong personality like Donald Trump, who can instantly define the opposition in ways that moves the needle even within corporate media, and then without that, who is clearly going to be the leader for the next generation, whether he ever ran for office himself or not. But because of what he brought to the table, that was going to, particularly with the younger generation, keep people on a narrow road. You know, we're down our two best players moving forward. And so we're going to have to figure out now how we're going to run this team and make a winning team so that, Jenna, we don't succumb to what happened in Western Europe. What you see in Western Europe right now is the same steps. First, the church abrogated the public square and diminished itself. So that happened first. So the moral center is gone. All right. Then the so-called right just becomes basically an amalgamation, a conglomerate of corporate interests that just don't want to be controlled, have their profit margins limited by the state, but have no real moral core whatsoever. Then what happened is because when the spirit of the age came to bear, and in the end, neither the corporatists and the statists basically had the same moral code and worldview at the core. They then just, you know, proved Hegelian's dialectic. The antithesis and the synthesis just joined together to form a new, the two antitheses just joined together to form a new synthesis. And then that left scores of people without agency politically, and they just became more and more retarded and reactionary to the point that they couldn't win elections anywhere because people just thought they were certifiably nuts, all right? And now they're in a position where they can't vote their way out of anything in Western Europe. If you are a non-communist, Brexit was your last chance. They completely screwed you in the aftermath of that, and you can't get out of it now. And the minimum that they're going to have to do to change what's happening to them is Tiananmen Square, St. Petersburg, or Leningrad level. You know, you look at, go back and look at the protests that toppled the Soviet Union in the early 90s. That level of civil unrest is the minimum they're going to have to do to get their way of life back. And then there may be some things, frankly, we don't want to have to discuss in public they might have to do. And the idea that those that could not be our dynamic here is not true. And in fact, we're only about a couple decades, if maybe less, away from being in that position, because what you're seeing with Mamdani is he is the new Harold now. What he will be, what the Democrat Party is moving forward. For about 10 minutes early this year, Gavin Newsom tried sanity. Put Charlie on his show, tried going on Fox News. He got absolutely annihilated. So that's over. Okay? So moving forward, Mamdani and the stuff that used to just be hinted about on MSNBC's televised insane asylum is now the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And I think we need to understand that. And sending a bunch of technocratic, soulless, corporatist Republicans up against an evangelistic campaign and crusade, which is what that kind of politics really is. It's a religious, missional. It's an evangelistic effort. We'll get annihilated. If we cannot speak to the soul, we will not win significant elections anymore. And then you'll even see us lose statewide in red states. Like there's already Democratic governors in Kansas and Kentucky. And I could see a Democratic governor winning my home state of Iowa next year if we nominate the wrong candidate.
Yeah, and Steve, I think you're absolutely right that this is really a spiritual fight. And it's interesting that so many people of kind of the old guard and who understand America's founding really somehow have this mentality that America is isolated and insulated from the Islamification, from the overwhelming, just terrible things that are going on in Europe and other countries that were somehow insulated from what happened, you know, years and years ago with the fall of Rome, that somehow we are a blessed nation just because we're America, and that things like that could never happen to us. And so we have a Republican Party that right now is at a crossroads, and absolutely we are losing our two best players. And I think that what we saw with the election, where Trump's endorsements really didn't carry as much of weight, and I'm hearing rumors of kind of the lame duck going forward with Trump because he's at his political waning point. And especially right now, if you have a Republican Party that genuinely doesn't want to govern, and that's what I see with the Correct. The people in Washington, not just the old guard, but even with those who are coming up, there is this this apathy that I think is different generationally. And so it's different reasons, but it's the same problem that if they really wanted to govern, they would remove the filibuster right now. And they would say, we're not letting the minority Democrats just, you know, hamstring us and run out the clock. But they're so scared of doing anything because they would rather actually be in the minority. They're acting like they're in the minority when they have the trifecta and they have all of the tools at their disposal. And so I see this apathy as a form of this just kind of this really bizarre cognitive dissonance of thinking that America somehow isn't going to succumb to all of the evil that we've seen in other countries.
We're at the stage now where if you don't have some baseline connection to Christianity and some baseline modicum of a biblical worldview, you're useless. And the reason why is because you won't truly understand what it is we are up against. You won't, what you did was just further quantify the lament I opened our conversation with. You pointed to a practical example that fleshed out of what I was theoretically addressing, in that there's too many people, particularly in Washington, with R's after their names, who think that this is just we're still negotiating. And this is like in A Dark Knight Rises when Scarecrow says, this is not a trial. There's no evidence to present here. This is a sentencing. I mean, we're post-argument. All right? We had one guy left who was still willing to go and argue. They shot him in the throat. We're post-debate here. We're post-argument. The time for arguments is at an end to the other side. And I think we have to understand that. This isn't a negotiation. They're not negotiating right now. We're going into 2 months of a government shutdown. And they're not negotiating on a daily basis. They're certainly not going to negotiate after, you know, the election results on Tuesday. What's the leverage? What's the leverage point? And a lot of these Republicans think that, well, you know, these are just talking points. This is just cynical politics. No, it's not. Maybe. And here's the thing: it might even be that for a lot of Democrats in Washington D.C., but their survival instincts are kicking in. And they didn't race to go out and endorse Mamdani. They didn't. But they waited until his victory was basically assured, and then they did. And now they realize, you know what, man, in the end, better to have a chair to sit in when the music stops, even if that music is in Arabic, than having no chair at all. And that's just, we are not going to be able to beat them without people who understand what we're really opposing. You know, we used to say a few years ago, do you know what time it is? Now I think we need to say is, do you know what we're up against? Do you know what we're facing? We're not doing political campaigns anymore. These are rival evangelistic expeditions and missions. This is like if the local communist and Sheik and Billy Graham, you know, were sharing a stage together during the Cold War with you know, differing messages of ways of life and beliefs, that both attempting to, you know, simultaneously speak to the soul. That's what Mamdani is doing. You know, the people of New York City, you know, they've been weighed, measured, and found wanting. They've been, that meat's been tenderized, and now it's ready to be grilled. I mean, they first tried godless corporatists. Post-Giuliani, their mayors had been godless corporatists like Bloomberg. They tried an open Sandinista communist in de Blasio, who was a literal Sandinista. He operated out of the Sandinista offices in New York City during the 1980s. They tried both those forms of godlessness, so they're now ready for their new God, Jenna. The new God, the false God, of course, but the new God is here. And I think we have to understand that. This, people are voting for him because he's giving them, he's filling the God-shaped hole in their heart. And if we cannot speak to that, we're toast.
And now we have on the right, we have this internal bizarre fight that includes the rise of anti-Semitic content with, you know, the Tucker Carlson, Nick Fuentes interview. And then bizarrely, Heritage Foundation jumps into this when nobody asked them and actually defends Tucker. And then Kevin Roberts comes out and says, oh, well, I didn't really know what Nick Fuentes stood for. Well, maybe you should have thought about that before you went out and defended him. But it's like we're talking about all of this nonsense on the right that we should have been against and settled, you know, at the very conception of our country, much less in 2025. And so why is the right just so, I mean, they like to say the Democrats are in disarray, but I think the right is actually in disarray because we don't have the common moral standard that we used to, which used to be the Christian worldview and the understanding of first principles.
Well, you just answered your own question. I mean, godlessness is not confined in the intellectual grocery store to just the aisles on the left of the store. It's everywhere. And, you know, this goes to what I said earlier. This fits the pattern of what happened in Europe. And so, you know, you look at Virginia's election results, you know, from 1968 to 2004, 10 presidential elections, Republicans won them all. Now, what's happened since, you know, Virginia has a unique situation where the massive growth of government, starting with Bush Rove, guns and butter, Obama, what we're doing now, there's scores of government workers that live in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. They all vote Democrat. And Virginia is a suburban heavy state. And you know, we've grown, under Trump, our coalition has changed. Our coalition is more rural and non-college educated. And their coalition has now become more suburban and college educated. And so two trends happened at the same time to change a lot of the makeup of the worldviews in our suburbs. First, a lot of our biggest megachurches are in the suburbs. And a lot of those churches just gave up on discipleship in this last generation. They didn't want to build a kingdom. They wanted to build a brand instead. All right. And so just like I said, in Western Europe, the church in the suburbs collectively abrogated. What came next was the universities went hard left, not liberal, like Soviet left. They raised communist indoctrination. And that's where a lot of college-educated people, where do they live? In the suburbs, all right? And there's no bulwark of believers because they're all going to the most watered-down churches in the country, and that has moved the suburbs culturally to the left. And this is a problem that we have across the country. We can still, you know, Trump has lost the suburbs in his last two elections, but in 2024, he only lost them by two, so he was very competitive. How did that happen? He had a strong economic message to counter Biden's poor economic record, because a lot of times people also live in the suburbs because they like to keep the money. Well, the problem we have right now is we don't have a strong economic message. Our current economic message appears to be we will manage deficit spending in Obamacare better than Democrats. And we don't have a strong economic record. And as much as I love Trump, I cringe when I see him out there talking about how much the stock market's going up, because I can just see next year in the midterms, Democrats turn around and say, he's just another Republican talking about the stock market. Well, you can't afford a pound of beef. I can just see this coming. Well, a pound of beef is $8, but he's talking about the stock market. Just another billionaire. I can see that coming a mile away. All right.
That's exactly what they're doing right now with the shutdown. You know, they're saying, you know, they don't care about SNAP benefits, and they're not actually talking about what the Democrats are doing.
Yeah, they're going to find themselves as they're the populace now. Correct. And so we don't have a strong economic message and record right now to counter how culturally left the suburbs have gone. And so we got annihilated in the Virginia suburbs. You look at Loudoun County, Virginia, right? One of the biggest suburban areas in America. 500,000 suburbanites live in that county, nearly 500,000. Winsome Sears got 63% of those that voted for Trump in 2024. Abigail Spanberger got 82% of those residents who voted for Kamala Harris in 2024. Yikes, that's the whole Virginia state election statewide right there, is that trend line right there. All right. So we ran a candidate I have no idea what Winsome Sears thinks about Maha. I don't know what she thinks really about a lot of the issues that we discuss every time I come on your show. So our new coalition is MAGA Maha. That's our base now. Okay, we have to have candidates that inspire that base, number one, to get them to turn out for them. And Winsome Sears didn't do that. And that's one of the big reasons we lost on top of the economic record.
Well, you know, Steve, I appreciate your all of your thoughts, and we need to continue to discuss this because unlike the people who are saying, the Democrats were going to win anyway because, you know, hey, this is New Jersey, this is Virginia. I think that this is more serious than that, and we have to take a much, much closer look at where the Republican Party is and, frankly, where it's not headed so that we can make sure that we correct this ship before the midterms. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the Supreme Court heard an argument yesterday over global tariffs, and CNN's headline is takeaways from Trump's rocky Supreme Court argument. So they're already hoping, I think, that Donald Trump will lose, but isn't that typical of CNN? But they said the Supreme Court appeared deeply concerned Wednesday with President Trump's reliance on vague federal law to impose global tariffs, with several members of the court's conservative wing picking apart the administration's position in a case that could have sweeping implications for the economy and also presidential power. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel for the Lawfare Project. And Gerard, could you briefly just walk us through the case that the court heard yesterday and what the argument actually or what the question in this case actually was?
Well, this all stems from President Trump's use of a declaration of a national emergency under a law known as IEEPA to impose tariffs on many, many countries. This is the vast majority of the tariffs that the Trump administration have been imposed have been under this authority, which really requires there to be an emergency and a national emergency, and that's why Congress has delimited this power to the president. The challenge to these tariffs is that IEEPA does not actually explicitly mentioned tariffs, and that this is not actually a national emergency because the trade deficit has existed for decades and is a long-standing problem. And finally, essentially, that this is a separation of powers issue, that something like this, it would be a major delegation of power that the president has with tariffs, and that was something that belongs to the House of Representatives, to Congress, and has not been delegated in this case. And so overall, the argument is that Trump's tariffs are unconstitutional because they are not relying on a valid apportionment of power under the law.
And, you know, and from just a conservative perspective and we're originalists, I think, here, it doesn't mean then that we just automatically go to, well, the Trump administration should win because we like the outcome. And for listeners, you know, that should always be the case, that we want a good precedent and for the Supreme Court to hold according to the Constitution, not just the outcome that we prefer. And so there's a couple of really serious issues here, I think, including what you just described, the major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine, basically that the executive branch can't step into the shoes of the legislature. And this gets to the overall frustration that the legislature isn't legislating, because if they wanted to cure this, they could with the House and Senate, they could pass legislation that allowed for this, but they're not doing that. So that's one problem. But the bigger issue, as I see it, is this use of emergency powers, because what we saw during COVID, especially on the state level, was an abuse of so-called emergency authority that rightly needed to be confined to an actual emergency and something that was not just open-ended and so far extended that it basically allowed the executive to step into the legislature's shoes. I mean, that's literally what we argued in, for listeners who are aware of John MacArthur's case against Gavin Newsom, and argued that exact same issue. And I think we were right on that issue. We never really got to those merits, but it's basically the same question that's coming up in this case. And so why would the Trump administration want to use emergency powers here when we've seen that exact framework so abused as recently as 2020?
Well, I think that's the problem. That you mentioned two things that are very key to this. One of them is that Congress is not doing its job. And this is not just about the government shutdown. This is a systemic problem that we've seen for many years now, where Congress passes laws that are vague enough to give the executive, the president, wiggle room on how to interpret them and how to actually apply things like emergency powers. So part of it is that Congress does not do its job. It doesn't sit there and think in detail of what powers to give the president or what is needed for the country, even in an emergency. The second part of it is that Trump wants to be able to get an outcome. And going back to the Senate to ratify every treaty, or going to Congress to ask permission, essentially, to impose tariffs when doing so is in the national interest, he wants to read the authority that he has in the broadest possible way, basically to get things done. But this goes back to the problem. We want to do things the right way, because these powers have been abused by other executives, whether it's past presidents or governors, and we want to make sure that the process is followed, because we've seen abuses in the past, not just with COVID, but with all sorts of laws and regulations that were imposed, saying that there are climate emergency or gender emergencies or everything else under the sun. So really, it is a process issue. And while I commend President Trump for wanting to take decisive action, we really do need to be careful that the law is followed.
Right. And so as the CNN article mentioned, and, you know, it's I know that listeners are like, you're quoting CNN. Oh, no. But, you know, but I think that they rightly point out that even the conservative members of the court were really reticent to accept this argument from the Trump administration. So where do you think the Supreme Court, based on the arguments yesterday, is poised to rule on this?
Well, leaving aside CNN's commentary, it's actual the facts that it points to are actually correct, that there was considerable skepticism even from conservative justices, Chief Justice Roberts. We had very, very probing questions from Justice Gorsuch. Even Amy Coney Barrett had very probing questions about congressional intent and whether or not there was silence on duties and imports and taxes. So I think that the court here will not just narrowly but pretty decisively say that this is an excess of the authority granted to the president under IEEPA and roll back the tariffs. Now, that doesn't mean that Trump won't find another doctrine or another law to apply, but it will force the administration to walk a more careful line going forward.
And I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who's senior counsel of the Lawfare Project, about the Supreme Court case that was argued yesterday about the presidential tariffs. And if the court rules against the administration, what are the practical consequences? I mean, for example, the existing tariffs that the Trump administration has collected, you know, business planning, importers and global trade. This has been Trump's preferred economic plan and solution. So what are the practical consequences?
Well, the practical consequences, and this came up in the oral arguments as well yesterday, the best way to describe it is that it'll be a mess. Some of these tariffs will need to be rolled back. Why I say some, because not all the tariffs are being challenged in this case. Some tariffs are not being challenged because other courts have ruled that they're appropriate. So first, the government has to see which tariffs need to be stopped or rolled back. Then the question becomes, what happens with all the revenue that's been collected? Refunding it might be a problem because that will create an administrative nightmare for the government. It may be that the Supreme Court, if it addresses this at all, could just kind of condone what's happened to date and not require a rollback, just put this going forward, essentially an injunction. But that's the big question, is what happens to businesses who can't plan and have not been able to plan for the future because they simply don't know what's going on with tariffs.
Yeah, that would create an utter mess, but it doesn't mean that the court then should just say, okay, well, just because it'll create a mess, then, you know, conversely, the court would just uphold the administration's argument because of the precedent that it might set, as we've discussed. And so this is a mess, but it's also going to, I think, have a large impact on the midterms, because this case, of course, will will be ruled on before the end of the term next summer. And it's obvious that this is Trump's chosen economic intervention to try to improve things. And he's trying to get things done as much as he can through executive order, because really we saw with what happened with DOGE and what's even happening right now with the budget arguments and everything moving forward, that really there's no zeal at all among either side in Washington to actually reduce spending or deal with our economic problems in any other fashion. So could this potentially have a major political impact on the midterms if this is the case that Trump loses?
I think it will have a major impact, and the extent of that impact depends on how both parties play it. We've already heard that Trump is considering having a convention next year, an off year, so to speak, because conventions are usually held only in presidential elections, but a convention next year to amp up support for Congress candidates and Senate candidates, which would be a unique opportunity for him to argue, look, the Supreme Court struck this down. I'm having to do everything by executive order because I don't have a Congress that will work with me. Vote for more Republicans. Flip side is Democrats will use the same arguments. We need Democrats in office because Trump is ruling by fiat and by executive order, and that's not appropriate. So this will become an example of why people need to get out to vote, and both parties will be using this for rousing support for their candidates.
Yeah, and it's going to be very interesting with all of these things kind of converging, and we're also seeing how the government shutdown is going on, you know, several months now, and whether or not that resolves before Thanksgiving, the holiday travel, and, you know, how much of this Republicans are going to actually be able, optics-wise, to correctly pin on the Democrats when, you know, frankly, I think they're winning the shutdown battle because the Congress and the Republicans just simply don't want to utilize power. And I was talking about this in the first segment. We've been talking about this kind of throughout the government shutdown, is that it seems like Congress, one of the main problems in this issue as well, just do not want to do their job. They don't want to actually govern. And that is a problem overall with the Republican Party, and why Trump signed, you know, several hundred executive orders on his first day. But for the last year, we have been, you know, screaming from the rooftops that Congress needs to step in and legislate on these things so that we don't get to a Supreme Court argument like this. And so that we don't get to, you know, some of these other problems that are going to continue to arise. And so are there other issues maybe on the horizon, Jared Folletti, that may either are poised to be argued at a lower court of the Supreme Court, or may be challenged if Congress doesn't actually follow through and some of these executive orders that Trump has signed?
Well, we're seeing a continuing battle in the courts about President Trump's call up of the National Guard, about the use of, we have lawsuits coming about ICE and the authority of federal agencies. We have lawsuits that are pending about deportation and free speech. All of these are playing out essentially because there's been a lack of enforcement at a local level, and President Trump is using authority that he claims under the Constitution to address these problems. All of these are going to be heard by the Supreme Court at some point in the next year, and this will also have an impact on the elections. Beyond that, we've got economic problems in this country that, while not something that's going to come before the high court, they're also adding to the frustration of voters that Congress isn't doing enough to help the American people.
Yeah, and these cases and these arguments are covering some really big themes, and it won't just have a temporary or present day impact on, you know, what's going to happen in the midterms and then how that will shape up for the 2028 presidential election. But these cases also have a precedential value for, you know, decades to come, if America persists that far and if the Lord tarries. But, you know, we do have to be concerned about precedent. And that's where the Supreme Court is at a very sticky point here, where, you know, there are the practical realities, but they have to look at the law as written and also the precedent that it sets. And so, you know, how should, in an ideal sense, how should the conservative wing of the Supreme Court look at these issues? I mean, they don't take politics into consideration, nor should they. But these are really delicate questions.
I think the conservative wing needs to go, what they always do is they go back to the origins, the Constitution, to the drafters, to the intent and the language. And what we're seeing, I think, over the last few years now and going forward is more than at any time in recent history, we're seeing the court examining how far the president can go and how far Congress can go. Basically, it's going back to the Constitution and delimiting powers. We've seen this with the discarding the Chevron doctrine, deference to agency rulings, for example. We've seen this with other decisions in the last few years, and this is really what's before the court. How far can a president go? How far does Congress need to act? These are things that conservatives are looking at the Constitution and looking what was going on when this country was founded. What powers did we really intend to give to each branch? And this is an opportunity for this to be refined and reinforced so that going forward, no matter who's in office, we are all protected by the same law.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Supreme Court hopefully will, I mean, I have a little more confidence because we do have a conservative wing and, you know, hopefully this will be shaped well into the future. But it seems like there are so many challenges right away for everything that Donald Trump does. And then yet, you know, the Biden administration got away with a lot. I mean, thankfully, there were a couple of very, very critical cases that were contended at the Supreme Court that ultimately, shaped those emergency powers and curtailed a lot of what the government was trying to do in terms of overextending their authority. But do you anticipate that with now Mamdani and a lot of what his policy view is in New York City, if he actually tries to carry out some of these things, like, I mean, you know, some of the really wild suggestions, like, you know, the government going and seizing private property, like these vacation homes, to ensure that all of the homeless have a place to stay and, you know, redistributing wealth and property on that scale. I mean, obviously, you know, completely antithetical to law and policy in this country. That some of those actions, if he tries to carry them out, will be someone will file suit as strongly as it seems like the left is prepared to go at President Trump.
Oh, I can constantly say that if we start seeing these policy ideas actually start to be implemented, there are many people who are lined up to exercise their legal rights to prevent this abuse of the law. The government can't just seize property, for example. There are processes and it has to go through courts. And this will be an opportunity of many for the Constitution to actually be applied and for state law to be applied and for Mamdani's excesses to be reined in. I think that a lot of what Mamdani campaigned on are empty promises that cannot be legally kept. But that's the point. If he tries to keep those promises, there are people ready to challenge them. And the legal system, I think, will rule in their favor.
Well, let's hope so. And hopefully the organizations like, Judicial Watch and, some of these others, ADF, are going to be preparing, you know, lawsuits right away. So, George Folletti, really appreciate it. And, of course, the Lawfare Project hopefully should get involved as well. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as Steve Dace mentioned in the first segment, there are a lot of other Republican elections coming up that are going to be, you know, really hotly contested, and we have to make sure to nominate the correct candidates for that. And he has endorsed a candidate in his home state of Iowa, Adam Steen. So, of course, I wanted to have Adam on the program to hear from him and find out about his campaign. You can find out about that at AdamSteen, STEEN.com. So good morning, sir, and congratulations on what I think is the most important endorsement in Iowa, of course, and that is Steve. So already you're off to a great start, but let listeners know about you, who you are, and why you're running.
Well, good morning, Jenna. I appreciate being here, and you are correct. That was a big, big step for our campaign. It was an honor. I was very, very humbled for that moment. So Steve's a great guy. He had a great following. He's had a great worldview. Yeah, I jumped in this race, on August 19th to preserve and protect the culture of Iowa. We are at risk right now in Iowa of losing the freedoms and the culture that we have worked so hard to create. I have two boys. They're 10 and 8. I've been married for 13 years. And when Governor Reynolds announced that she was not going to run, I looked at the landscape. I spent a lot of time in prayer, and we realized that I had to jump into this race to ensure that the future for my boys is protected here in the state.
And, you know, that's wonderful. And I love the banner that you have on your website that says pro-life, pro-family, pro-property rights, pro-Iowa. I mean, this is just such a contrast to everything right now that the left and the Democrat Party is for. You know, they are basically anti-life, anti-family, anti-property rights. And so we could say maybe, you know, anti any of the states and the governors and the leaders that should be in office. And so in each of these, you know, let's kind of break this down in terms of, you know, pro-life and pro-family, where you stand and what you think the position of the governor, how you're going to protect those rights.
Yeah. So Governor Reynolds signed a heartbeat bill, which is a 6-week abortion ban. I am life at conception, so I think 6 weeks is fine. But we need to move further, and we need to protect life at conception. So that's, you know, kind of full stop on that. But then from a family perspective, I believe fully that the government has infiltrated our lives, that families, churches have abdicated their responsibility, and the government has stepped in, and people are far too reliant on the government for help. That's not how we were created. That's not why we exist as human beings. And so I will be an advocate for families to get back to the dinner table, to sit down, to have real conversations with each other, to look each other in the eye, to talk about their day, which sounds kind of weird and awkward, but it's what we need to be doing. We need to get off the devices. We need to get away from our distractions, focus on our family and who we are, who we were created to be. And then I'm going to be calling for the local church to rise up and start to take back the responsibility of their, not just their parishioners, but their communities as well. The local church has sat back. The local church right now with SNAP benefits being, you know, not available, the local church needs to get their communities up and going and to fund food banks and to help people find food rather than waiting for the government to reopen and waiting for the government to help them out. We've sat back too long. Government has creeped in, and I'll tell you, the Democrats are taking full advantage of that, and we've got to stop that through and through.
Yeah, I could not agree more with how the church used to be and biblically is supposed to be the one that cares for their immediate community. And this is the definition of the local church. And when we have abdicated responsibility of the family and also what the church should be doing to the government, government is not equipped for that. It's just not. I mean, this is why in the separation of powers that God himself ordained, government is not vested with parenting and, you know, raising children and that responsibility, nor can it do the functions of the local church. And in a better view of government, the civil government should be less and less, and that's a conservative principle and value. And so, you know, I love that worldview perspective, Adam Steen, because it rightfully, I think, puts government in its proper place and proper role.
Correct. You're exactly right.
one of the things I believe was attractive for the endorsement for Steve Dace was for 5 years, I have been operating the state. So I was in charge of administrative services for the state of Iowa for 5 years. So I was in the belly of the beast, running and operating the state, working with every single agency with inside the state of Iowa's government. And to your point, we are not equipped to do what we are trying to do as a government authority. That we're, number one, we're not equipped to do it operationally, but number two, that's not what we're supposed to do. The government exists to punish evil and condone good. That's it. And we have just let the government overreach and invade every area of our life. And again, operationally, we can't do it because we don't know what we're doing. We screw everything up on a regular basis. And then families sort of sit back and hope that the government can step in and help. And it will never happen because it's not what it's designed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how do you see the interplay between state and the federal government? Because, you know, I think those lines have also been very blurred, that the states are too reliant on the federal government. And, you know, my home state governor, Ron DeSantis, has been, you know, such an excellent example of what states should do. Kim Reynolds, of course, who's been the governor of Iowa, has been an excellent governor there. I mean, there are just a handful of great conservative governors that we can point to. How do you see your administration fitting into, you know, that legacy, and how do you want to take that forward?
Yeah, no, I think DeSantis and Governor Reynolds in many areas have been a great example to follow. I look forward to working, one, with the Trump administration and walking alongside what President Trump is doing from his bold sort of leadership perspective, his business perspective. I was 18 years in the private sector as a business owner. So I've got that business mind. I've got the boldness sort of mindset built into me. So walking alongside President Trump will be absolutely critical. But then also there's some things that have come down from the federal government that have been very eye-opening from my perspective as I was operating the state. One was some federal grants were removed from two entities that I oversaw, the State Historical Society and the State Library. And I worked with those entities. They said, well, we're not going to be able to operate without these federal grants. I said, well, go back, turn the screws on the agency, sharpen your pencils. Then they came back and they said, well, actually, we didn't need these federal grants. We could just remove these subscriptions. We can cut waste here. And all of a sudden, it opened up the door we've been wasting money for years. We didn't realize it. So I look forward to those types of relationships with the Trump administration, because I'm telling you, there's a ton of waste out there. There's a ton of overreach out there. And identifying that quickly and then cutting it out will be absolutely key for state operations going forward.
And I'm speaking with Adam Steen, who is running for governor of Iowa, because, of course, Kim Reynolds has declared that she is not running. So he is running for governor. You can find him at adamsteen.com. And also, I'd encourage you to follow him on social media. And I do want to get to quickly the pro-property rights element here, because this is such a contrast between what we've seen from the left and now especially their possibly furthest to the left pro communism now mayor-elect of New York City, who has said, you know, that he believes that that property even should be redistributed, and there's an entitlement to people that are homeless to property that is given by the government. And so, you know, obviously, you know, this is completely unconstitutional, but it's also against a fundamental right of every human being made in the image of God. So how do you respond to the election of Mandami?
It's the height of insanity. I there's no other way to describe it. Unfortunately, I wasn't surprised because that's the nature of the world right now. It's good versus evil right now. And we need people that are willing to stand up and call that out. And the thought of taking people's property is the height of insanity. The thought of bringing in a Muslim communist socialist to run the largest city in the United States is the height of insanity. And we have to guard against that. We have to protect against that. We have to be able to call good, good, call evil, evil. We have to stand together. And honestly, this is an amazing time for people to pray and to focus on the Lord, focus on their faith, and figure out what it is that the Lord is doing here. Because I believe we're in the middle of an awakening. And if we're not ready, this country, and especially the state of Iowa, we're going to miss the Holy Spirit come through with revival. And we have to be ready for that. And the election of Mondami, it's another awakening moment. Like, if we're not shook by what is happening right now, if we're not willing to stand up and fight back, we're in trouble. We're in trouble.
Well, you are standing up and fighting back, so have a lot of courage. And Adam Steen, really appreciate you joining this morning. And I'd encourage listeners, especially if you're in Iowa, if you have friends in Iowa, send them to adamsteen.com to learn more. Follow him at Adam Steen on X on social media. And he's absolutely right. This is the moment to pray for our country, pray for our leaders, and also make sure that we understand our worldview so that we can go and affect our nation. As always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.